Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Mary Ann. I'll try to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I could do that in a very short sentence. My life spiraled down to hell, and somebody shared Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and my whole life and my whole world turned around and changed. But I'll tell you a little bit more than that. I've asked Billy to help me keep an eye on the clock. He had some cookies over there, and you know, he said they had cookies before the meeting and sometimes cake after the meeting. And I said, you probably don't want me to have that, because once I get started, I may have a hard time shutting up. So if y'all get through before I do, feel free to get up and go get coffee, go to the bathroom, leave if you need to, whatever. I feel like I've been around here a long time. I'll tell you about my first introduction to AA. I was born into an alcoholic household. My dad was the alcoholic, and my mother was the person who alcohol never touched her lips, but she had a lot of vices of her own. And I don't know if any of you, you may not have heard of this fellow, but when I talk, I always have to mention a fellow. His name was Rudy Freed. He is dead now. He died with 50-plus years in sobriety, and he was a member of the Waynesboro group and the Stanton group all of the years that he was sober. And he 12-stepped my dad into recovery. And I am so grateful for that, because I never knew my dad as a practicing alcoholic. Now, having said that, I heard a lot of the stories from my mother, because she hung on to them for a while. Al-Anon was really not formed at that point, and I heard someone talking before this meeting started that the Al-Anon or Lois would go into the kitchen with the women, and the men would go in with Bill, and they would talk about whatever they was going to talk about, sobriety or, you know, whatever. And the women would go into the back room at that point in time, and they would talk about what their men had been doing, because they didn't have the program of Al-Anon. And the men, mostly all men, would be out in the main room, and they would be telling funny stories and laughing. And I always wanted to be out in the big room with the men. I knew my place. I knew I didn't belong back there with the Al-Anons, and had no idea the road that I would travel to have to be out there with the AAs. So I never saw my dad drink. My mother used to keep this chest, and it had all of these letters in it. And it was letters that my dad had written to other women when he was out there drinking, to remind her of where he had been. And I never really understood that, why she hung on to those. But I grew up the first 13 years of my life going to AA meetings. And I have a lot of wonderful memories of being in AA meetings. I still belong to the group that I went to as a child with my dad and with my mother. We have met in the same church since 1957, and they met in another part of the church. They actually built that room for the AA meetings. And I sat there a lot of times. I was there yesterday, and I was looking around, and I was just thinking, oh, I can hear so many of those old-timers telling their stories. And what a gift. What a gift. But my memory of that time was going around and picking up families. We had a big station wagon. And a lot of the guys had lost their driving permits, or they didn't have a car anymore, or whatever. And we would go pick up the whole family, and we would take them to meetings. So I grew up knowing a lot of sober alcoholics. Now, there were some drunks around on the outer edges of my family, but none that I saw in my household. My sister would have had a totally different, or would have, a totally different recollection of her life. She's 17 years older than I am, and she lived through a lot of my dad's alcoholism. But in 1948, Rudy had found sobriety. Some people had come over from Charlottesville, and some people had come from Richmond, and you had to travel a lot then to get to a meeting. There wasn't a meeting on every corner. There weren't lunchtime meetings. You had to get in the car and travel. And I remember my mother telling this one story. She said, you know, I had to go borrow money and pay for your dad to go all the way to Richmond to get detoxed. Now, I would have wished that she would have remembered, you know, maybe the difference in him after that, not so much how much money it cost her, but, you know, that's, she grew up with alcoholism in her home, and so she had seen a lot of it, and she had suffered through it. But Rudy 12-step, my dad, he actually had been put in Western State. He was from a well-to-do family in Waynesboro. And he had been put in Western State, and they had told him that that's where he was going to live the rest of his life, being the drunk that he was. And when I think about that today, and I think about the old-timers who reached out to him, and because of that, he had a totally different life, and his wife had a totally different life, and his children had a totally different life, and I have a totally different life because of that. And I am grateful for that. I try to always remember that we can't keep it unless we give it away. You know, I can be selfish, and I can be self-centered, and I can say, oh, this is for me. But if I don't give it away, I'm not going to be able to keep it. So that's why I'm here tonight. I don't know that I will say anything that any of you will relate to, hopefully a little bit, somewhere along the line. My dad died on my 13th birthday. And I remember that morning well. I was up and I said, Dad, can I stay home with you today? Dad and I were like this. And Dad had that, he had found in Alcoholics Anonymous that inner peace that we talk about. And I could sit beside of him, and it was like I could feel the peace ooze out of his pores. And Rudy was the same way. And I knew that I didn't have that. I knew that there was a restlessness within me that at some point would need to be tamed. And I didn't know how on earth that was going to happen. And I asked him that morning, I said, Dad, let me stay home with you. It's my birthday. I want to spend it with you. And he said, no. He said, I got to go check on my men. He said, you go on to school. And he said, we'll do something special when you come home. And they came and got me that morning at about 10 o'clock in the morning. And he had dropped dead. His lungs had collapsed, and he had gone up to check on his men, and he had dropped dead. My world fell apart. I did not want to be left alone with my mother. I thought she was angry. I didn't feel any peace come from her at all. And here my best friend had gone and left me, and I didn't really understand why. And that became my license to drink. So at 13, any excuse will do. At 13, I took my first drink of alcohol. I had a six-pack. I had a blackout. I ended up somewhere I didn't know how I got there and did not remember who I was with. And that tells you a lot of my history. I was a blackout drinker. And I set out to prove that at that point I was an adult, that nobody was going to tell me what I could do, that I wasn't going to listen to my mother, that she didn't know anything, and I knew everything. And that's the way I lived my life. And I could walk in just about anywhere at 13, 14, 15 years old, and I could buy anything I wanted. And I said, you know, I look at these young kids today, and all of them look like they're 12 to me, probably because I've gotten so much older. But I could walk in anywhere, and I could buy it. And actually, I started hanging around with a lot of older kids, and we would go to Charlottesville, and we would go get on the road, and we would go somewhere to try to find the party, to try to find the bar, to try to find the dance hall, to try to find, you know, that bright lights. I still have to be kind of careful around bright lights today. I don't do that because it kind of speak to me. So I try to stay in a little bit more calm environment, though I do know how to act somewhat today. And they would always send me in to buy. And we had one older girl. She was about 3-5 years older than I was, I think. And she wouldn't go in and buy anything. I said, Pulper, and stop. I'll go in. And we would, and I would. And, you know, at that time, didn't have to be... you know, I could get in anywhere. And one of my favorite hangouts, and I don't know, y'all are somewhat close to Charlottesville, but one of my favorite hangouts became the Cavalier in Charlottesville. I don't know if any of y'all remember that place or not. It burnt down once, and they built it back, and then it... I think there's a little Italian restaurant or some there. Something like that there now. And I went there, and... for years, went in there, ordered anything I wanted, was never carded. But I went there on my 21st birthday, and they carded me. I don't know if they had a new person working or what. And they said, oh my God, you've been coming in here all these years, and you are just 21 now? You sold it to me, what can I tell you? And we would come to Charlottesville, and I was going out to Founders Day in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. They were having an archives part there and of the Founders Day, and I looked up on the hill going down, I guess it's 250, and there was a place there that I used to go as a teenager to dances. And I had never paid any attention to it, but going to that Founders Day, I went, oh, yeah, I remember that place. The day I turned 15, I got my driver's permit, and that was another license for me to drive and to drink. And when my father died, of course, my mother got Social Security for me, and she gave me the check. And I just thought that was wonderful, you know, because I had a car now, and I had money, and I could buy anything I wanted, and I could go anywhere I wanted to, and she couldn't stop me. I remember one time she tried to stop me, and she took the coil wires off the car, and she said, I got you. You're not going anywhere. She used to tell me all the time that I like to run up and down the valley pike. I never did really know what that meant. I know what it means today, but she said, you're not going anywhere tonight. I said, I'll show you. And I lived out in the county. I put my coat on and took off walking. I got a ride. I did the same thing that night that I did all the other nights that I was out there. Got into a lot of crazy relationships that I should not have been in. I know y'all don't know anything about crazy relationships. A lot of wrong places, a lot of wrong people, doing a lot of wrong things. And, you know, was just living life as hard as I could possibly live it because I was looking for something to fill that hole in my soul. And alcohol worked for a while. And I tried to pour as much into it as I possibly could. I graduated from high school by the skin of my teeth because I was much more interested in partying and staying out half the night and doing the fun things than I was going to school. The only thing I had ever thought that I might want to become was an attorney. And I've said for a lot of years that I made a conscious choice to drink over pursuing that career because I knew I would have to study. I knew I would not be able to drink the way I wanted to drink and hang out in the places that I was hanging out in. So I graduated from high school, didn't want to be there. I went out and partied every night. I was the one that had the car. I picked up all the people, and they went with me, and we'd be off to the races. I had gotten into this relationship with this guy who was an abuser and didn't know how to get out of it. Didn't know how to get away from him. My mother told me one time, she said, you know, I really think he's good for you. I don't know that she knew all of the physical abuse that I was taking or the emotional abuse. She said, he is the only one that's ever been able to control you. Well, the way he controlled me was with his fist or with, you know, emotional abuse or whatever. I finally got away from that guy. The next guy I got with, he was walking out in the middle of 250. In Waynesboro, and he had a fifth of liquor, turned up and was drinking it out in the middle of five lanes. And I looked at him and I went, my kind of guy, we can party together. I picked him up. Me and another friend of mine, Gail, took him back up to my apartment, and he had a friend with him, and we threw the two of them in the shower, their clothes and all on, and we proceeded to drink their liquor. The next day, I was driving down, I was living up on Afton Mountain, and I was driving down the mountain with my roommate, and I looked over at her, and I said, you know what? I'm going to marry him. She said, you are nuts. You are not going to marry him. You don't even know him. You haven't known him 8 hours. I said, I'm telling you, I'm going to marry him. That was in April, and in June, we got married. And we did a lot of partying and a lot of drinking together. And we had 2 children. We hung out at a lot of bars. We had good enablers. The grandparents loved for the kids to come and stay with them. So we'd take the kids and we'd go off and party. He had a good job. I had a good job. We had plenty of money. We had the white picket fence, and we were just going to go off and have this great and wonderful life. And alcoholism continued to progress, mine, and we separated and went back together 7 times. I went to the hospital many, many times, was hospitalized. The last 7 years that I drank, I was hospitalized for a week each one of those years. And not one doctor ever said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? They said, you have an ulcer. You have colitis. You have nerves. You have whatever. And they'd give me some prescriptions and send me on my way. I went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist, I thought he was pretty wise. I went to him. He told me I hated my sister. The only thing I'd ever told him about my sister was that I had one. I hadn't talked about her at all. And I had a prescription for some Valium. And he told me that he thought it might really help if I just smoke a little pot along the way, that it would help me to calm down. And I did. And I thought that was great advice. I really liked him. And he continued to write me prescriptions, and I continued to drink. He never asked me how much I drank. I don't know that I would have told him, but... Anyway, I got sicker and sicker and sicker, and we started to separate and go back together and separate and go back together. And finally, I had my own business. I had 7 employees. And one of the last times that we had separated, I remember going back to him. I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I was just, I didn't know what to do. I had tried to commit suicide several times. I'd slit my wrist several times. I took an overdose, a whole bottle of pills at one point, and I called the rescue squad. And I asked the rescue squad, I said, will you die if you take a whole bottle of pills? And I told them what kind I had taken, and they said, yeah. Where are you? Let us come and get you. Well, they couldn't see your phone number then. And I said, well, what should I do? And they said, well, if you don't get that stuff up out of your stomach, you are going to die. And they said, you've got to let us come and get you. And at least if you're not, then you need to go make yourself throw up until you get that stuff out. I said, okay, thank you very much. And I hung up the phone. I did not go to try to make myself throw up. I turned out the light. I laid down. And I went to sleep. God wasn't finished with me yet. In spite of me, God had other things in store. Well, in that end, I went back to that husband. We were living separately. He was living with his girlfriend, and I was raising the 2 kids by myself, and I was running this business, and I went back to him, and I said, you know, I've really realized that I can't live this way. Let's go back together, and we can make it all right. And he said, I don't think so. He said, I've found somebody else. I've had enough of your shenanigans. And I was left alone again. About the same time, I had 7 employees walk out and leave. because they had had enough of my craziness, my showing up with a hangover, my drinking, my partying, all of it. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and decided I would take a vacation. Now, I had this business to run. 7 employees had left. I wasn't going to be there, so I just shut the doors and took a vacation to Florida. And had another friend that went with me, and she drove, and I laid in the back seat and drank the whole way there and drank the whole way when we came back. And I decided, well, maybe if I'd get me a second job, that would make my life better. So I went over to Wintergreen, took another friend over there who was going over to apply for a job. And she said, why don't you apply too? And I said, well, you know, maybe that would be good. You know, get me out and, you know, all this stuff. And so I applied and they said, yeah, we'll hire you. And I was a cocktail waitress at Wintergreen. I'd never been a waitress in my life, didn't know anything about it, didn't know anything about serving drinks other than the way I mixed them, which was straight out of the bottle. And got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I left work one night and came to out of a blackout, and I was going 100 miles an hour down 151, for those of you who have been on 151. Another time I was always had my half gallon in the car with me, and you know, I was one of those people that could just, if the police pulled you over or whatever, I could kind of snap out of it. And I was at a blackout, came up to a stoplight. That's the only thing I remember all the way home. Went on down the street, and there was about 2 foot of snow. And I crossed the road, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. I crossed the road and headed dead straight for a tree. And when it hit the snowbank, I was right up against the tree. And my half gallon rolled out from under the seat, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. I pushed it back up under there. I got out of the car, I walked across the street, and I saw some people over there with lights on. And I went up and I said, can I use your telephone? And they said, yeah. I said, yeah, I fell asleep at the wheel. And I need to call my friend to bring the wrecker and come and get me and take my car in. And the police officer came by in Waynesboro, and I knew him. And he said, Marianne, are you okay? And I said, yeah, just I was working late, and I fell asleep at the wheel. And he said, go on home, get yourself some coffee. Go on up to Sambo's, get yourself some coffee. They didn't arrest women then like they do now. I'd be under the jail if they did, because I was pulled over a whole bunch. I was pulled over one time for going up Broad Street, and I was going 75 in a 35. And I was drunk as drunk could be. And they said, Marianne, go on up to Sambo's, get you a cup of coffee. And at that time, I got out in the middle of the street. And the police officer, he told me that the car inspection was out of date. I got out in the middle of the street and argued with him that it was not out of date. And he told me, go on up to Sambo's, get me a cup of coffee. And I did. And the next day, I came to enough to look at that inspection sticker, and it was out of date a year. I got pulled over on Main Street. Never could figure out why they turned the lights on in the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning. It just did not make sense to me because I was not done. I got pulled over, leaving the bar, closing the bar that night. And they made me get out and, you know, do the little touch your nose and hop on 1 foot. I can't do that sober. Evidently, I did it because he said, Marianne, go on up to Sambo's. And he pulled me over for driving too slow. That's how drunk I was. I couldn't see. So I had a lot of near misses for jail, and I consider myself blessed that I did not, that I have a driver's permit today, that I did not injure anybody else as far as I know. And I had a person come to work. He came knocking on my door. I called him a New York City slicker. I didn't know why, how in the world he ever showed up in Waynesboro. I didn't know why in the world he was coming knocking on my door for a job, but he did. And he came in, and people would come in and see him all the time, and I thought, now this guy just moved to Waynesboro. How does he know all these people? I thought, he's got to be a drug dealer. He's dealing drugs out of my business. And he would whisper to him on the phone, you know, and I just wasn't getting it. And he started saying things like, man, you look rough today. Would you like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Me? Man, I can drink anybody under the table. I've always been able to drink people under the table. I don't need to go to AA. I knew the sober drunks, and I knew that wasn't me. And he was pretty patient, and these people kept coming in and out, and took me a while to get that they were in AA too. And finally, one day, he said, I went to work, and I was rough. I couldn't get my head above my knees. I don't know if y'all ever felt like that or not, but I prided myself that I didn't drink in the morning. Now, I could drink till 5 or 6 and go to work at 7, but, you know. Finally, he said one night, he said, why don't you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with me? And I said, okay, under one condition. You buy me something to drink on the way to the meeting, and you take me out of my hometown. Because, you see, I know Rudy Freed, and I know Charlie, and I know all these people that go there. And they can see me being pulled over in Main Street, and they can see me drunk and streaking down Main Street, but they can't see me going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he agreed. He and his girlfriend took me to Harrisonburg, and I went to that first meeting. I don't remember anything that was said. I remember there was one girl there, and she had on this long black coat, and she had her coffee in her hand, and it was shaking like that. She kept spilling the coffee all over the table and the floor. And I thought, God, she needs to be here. When's this meeting going to be over so I can go get something to drink? And we left the meeting that night, and came back to Waynesboro. He and his girlfriend started arguing, and I went, I'm out of here. I got enough of this in my own history. I don't need it here. And I had one of those cars, if any of you've ever had them, that went on automatic when you left work. Well, mine went on automatic, and it either went to the little food mart, or it went to the liquor store, or went to the bar. And it went to the little food mart, and I got a tall Colt 45, because if I was only going to have one, it had to be strong. So I got that tall Colt 45, and I rode up to my father's grave. It was like 12 o'clock at night by then. I never went to the graveyard by myself. Now, I might have went to the graveyard partying with a bunch of people or, you know, whatever, but I'd never gone up there by myself at that time of night. And I said that prayer of desperation one more time. I said, God, take away the pain. I can't live like this. Strike me dead. I really don't care. I did not believe I was an alcoholic. I thought if I really wanted to, that I could quit. I had even proved to one of my drinking buddies, he had told me about a month before, he said, I want to make you a bet. You can't go 30 days without drinking. And I said, I'll bet you. I said, I won't drink any liquor for a month. I didn't. I just drank as much beer as I could and as much wine as I could and had as much of my other stuff as I could. And I really thought I had won that bet. I poured out the other half of that tall Colt 45. I didn't pour out alcohol of any kind. I didn't care if it was your leftover or what. Sometimes even your stale from the day before if we'd had a big party. But I poured that out, and I left that meeting, left that cemetery, and the next day went back to another meeting. And the next day went back to another meeting. And the next day went back to another meeting. I went to a meeting every day for the first year. They told me a lot of things that I didn't want to hear. They said, get yourself a female sponsor. I said, I don't like females very much. I get along much better with men. They said, we know. Get a female sponsor. So there was this lady that was coming down from, she was actually from Washington, D.C., and she and her husband had decided to move down to Elkton, and they were coming down on weekends. And they were coming over to Waynesboro to the meeting. And I asked her, I went up to her, and I went, will you be my sponsor? And I knew she was going to say, absolutely not. You got to be crazy. And she got a gleam in her eye. She said, I'd love to. And she was exactly what I needed. She was a kick butt sponsor. She told me things I needed to hear, not things I wanted to hear. She made me get a home group. She said, you've never been a part of anything in your life. If you are going to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're going to stay sober, you need a home group. She said, that's where you show up, and that's where you do your service. And if you don't, you won't stay. We had coffee cups then. They made me wash coffee cups. We had ashtrays then. Well, I was one of those crazy drunks that when I came in, I quit everything cold turkey. So I shook like crazy for the first year and drank a lot of coffee. They said, you can wash the dirty ashtrays. And I went, you've got to be crazy. What? How's washing dirty ashtrays going to keep me sober? It works. Had to stay after the meeting, and I had to talk to people. She told me, she said, I want you to, and at that time we had 100 pot coffee, 100 cup coffee pot. You had to show up an hour and a half early and make the coffee. And then you had to stay after and clean it up. And you had to sweep the floors and, you know, all that stuff. And she said, I want you to stand at the door and greet new people who are coming in. And I went, what am I going to say to them? She said, say welcome. You know, I thought it was some big important thing. Well, it was important, you know. And they told me not to make any geographical moves in the first year. Anybody heard that one?
No.
Well, that guy that kept after me about coming to AA, he had 13th stepped me into the program. They told me no emotional entanglements in the first year. There's a reason for that. And I backed up a truck in the middle of the night to my business and packed up everything that I had. This was right after those 7 employees had walked out and left. I took fixtures off the wall. I took things that did not belong to me. And we packed up and moved to Charlottesville, where I met Sandy. But we went to meetings every day. And You know, I think about some of those times today, and I think about, thank God, God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because had I done what I thought, I'd be dead, or I'd be under the jail, crippled, something. So I moved to Charlottesville, started going to meetings over there, and there was a gentleman over there. I went to the David C. Wilson meeting, and some of you know my friend Kevin from around here. I won't say his last name. He came to the meeting one night. I had about 3 months in the program, and he was just coming in. And there was this guy that was sitting there talking. And he was talking about these varmints crawling up his legs. And Kevin and I were both going, we were looking for the varmints that were, that's how green we were. We didn't know that there really weren't varmints crawling up his leg. At 3 months sober, they said, we don't have a GSR, you're it. I went, well, I don't know what that is, but I'm sure I can probably do it. And Lee Jennings decided he's dead now. And he said, we're going down to Ashland to an assembly. I went, okay. We got in the car and I went down to Ashland with him. And I got there and all these crazy people were standing up and arguing back and forth about money and archives. And those of you who know me know that I have a lot of history in archives. And I said, I am out of here. These people are nuts. I will never darken these doors again. And I left and stayed away for about, I don't know, 3 months till my sponsor made me get a home group and made me become GSR. I then took another geographical cure and moved to Harrisonburg and became a GSR over there for the Monday night group. And then became a DCM and also served at the area's the first treatment facilities chairperson. And there was this old guy, his name was Elwood, and he and another guy from Harrisonburg would come and pick me and another lady up, and they would drive us to all these assemblies and took our hand and showed us the ropes of this thing called service. And, you know, I am so grateful that throughout all of my craziness that people taught me about suiting up and showing up and giving back this program that I've been so freely given, that I did not deserve. And then I became the area chairperson, which was an interesting job, trying to control or keep in line or help 500 drunks get through a business meeting. And then I was given the honor and the privilege of being elected the area delegate for Virginia. And that was, I would have never, if you had told me when I went to that first meeting that I would have ever been given that honor and that privilege of carrying each one of your consciences to the General Service Office and being part of that, being part of 92 delegates from all over the United States and Canada, I would have said, no way. I'm just a crazy drunk. You know, and I am so grateful that I kept saying yes when I didn't even know what I was saying yes to. I have to tell you about one of my first memories of Sandy. There was a convention in Harrisonburg, Sandy and I went to a lot of meetings together in Charlottesville. And we had this 1980. We had this convention in Harrisonburg. And I think there are about four of us sharing the room. I don't remember all the details, but I go into the room. And here's Sandy, and she's sitting up in the middle of the bed, and she's in her meditation posture, and she's doing the oohs and the ahs and all this. And I looked, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm staying in here with a crazy person. How am I going to stay in the room with her doing this all weekend? And there were three others of us, and we left and went over to the pool and left Sandy off to her meditation. And Sandy and I have been friends for a long, long time. We shared a early meeting. We were talking about it coming on the way up here. There used to be a halfway house in Charlottesville. And we would go there on Sunday afternoons and take a meeting to the guys that lived there. And I can still remember sitting in there with old-timers and hearing them carry the message. And I'm so grateful for that. I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities in AA. I've had a lot of struggles in AA. I had 9 back surgeries. They told me I'd never walk again. I've been in a wheelchair. I've not been able to walk. I've been in excruciating pain for long, long, long periods of time. But you see me. I can stand today and I can walk. I just finished. I was talking to one of the gals before the meeting. I just went back to school, and for about the 15th time, I found out in AA that I do have a brain, and I can use it if I want to. And I've gone back and gotten a couple of different degrees, and I actually became a minister and was in the ministry for a while. I still preach every once in a while. Sometimes I preach at AA, but people don't want to listen. So sometimes I preach to sponsees, and they don't want to listen either. But I really try to share experience, strength, and hope. I went back to school over the last couple of years. At the ripe old age that I am, and I'm not going to tell you. I told you what year I was born, so if you can figure that out, then that's up to you. And I came out of that. I got a master's degree in professional counseling, and I had actually worked as a counselor before all of my back surgeries, before I became disabled. And I was out there and disabled for about 25 years. And just finished a degree and am back working at the agency that I worked at many, many, many years ago. And it's a privilege and an honor to have those relationships that have carried all of those years. They got to see me in earlier sobriety, and they've gotten to see me in later sobriety. I have 6 grandchildren. When my children were little, they went to meetings with me. They did not stay home with the babysitter, and they took their homework, or they sat over in the corner, and they did their homework, and they learned to be quiet. There are people still today that said, oh, I remember your kids when they were like this. They're both grown. And a couple of years ago, my daughter, youngest daughter, went through a very difficult time in her life, and her life fell apart. She tried to kill herself and came very, very close. She's a nurse, and she knew what to do and how to do it. God was not finished with her yet. She ended up, after taking all of these medications, she ended up calling the rescue squad because she was hallucinating. And she's not an alcoholic or a drug addict. She called the police and said that she could hear these children underneath her bed who were in a holding tank, and they couldn't get out and she couldn't get to them. And would they please come and help her to get these children out? Now, it was a hallucination. They came, they got her into the hospital. They told her she had liver damage. They told her there was absolutely no reason that she was alive. And she said, oh, yes, there is. She said, I know God. And God's not done with me yet. And part of the reason she did that was because she had been in an abusive marriage and her marriage had fallen apart and she didn't know how to get out of it and she had lost her children. She had lost 4 children. And they were, social services had come in and taken them. And you want to talk about something that is about the hardest thing you can ever go through in your life, being a grandparent and not being able to see your grandchildren and not being able to help your daughter and not being able to fix it. I'm a fixer. Was probably one of the hardest things that I've had to go through. I got custody of her oldest son. He was 16 at the time. He is still with me. He will be 20 this summer. And what a blessing he has been in my life. She has her children back. Her liver has healed. They don't know why. Medically, they don't know why. I've been through marriages. I've been through divorces. Somebody told me a couple of years ago, they said, you know, you don't have to marry every one of them. And I said, yeah, but I have this ethics thing, this moral thing, you know, since I've got sober, I can't just live with them. And you maybe ought to try that. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of those old timers and, you know, because of everything that I've been taught in AA and all the privileges that I've been given, I have those 6 beautiful grandchildren today. Not a one of them has ever seen me have to take a drink of alcohol. And I hope they never do. I am there for them today. They love going to meetings with me. I have a 7-year-old granddaughter and a 9-year-old grandson. And they ask me every time I go out the door, where are you going? To a meeting. Can I go? And especially if they know Sue's coming along. They love Sue. Sue and I have been privileged to work in the archives. I worked in the archives for the Virginia Area Archivist for 10 years. And I told them it was time for me to rotate. It is a permanent position. But I said it's time for somebody else to do it. So I rotated out for about, 12 or 13 years, something like that. And then the area officers came and said, would you please come back and do the archives again? We need to get it back up and going. And me and my insanity, I don't know how to say no to service work. And I've been back in there for the last couple of years. We just got Sue appointed as the alternate archivist. So I'm really looking forward to retirement and maybe her going into that position. If you've never been to the archives, we have a new office. It is your office. It houses your records, anything you want to send us. Please feel free to call Sue or myself up and come over and see. You get lost in there. You go in and you start reading some of these histories of how AA started, and you see these people who have come before us. And I go in to do one thing, and sometimes 2 or 3 hours later, and I'm going, I didn't get done what I was going to do because I got to reading this story. Please let us know if you ever want to come over and visit. I appreciate y'all for, I don't think anybody went to sleep. If you did, it's okay. There's something I always like to close with because I think it really says something about AA. It does to me. It always speaks to me. I'm a big book thumper. I try not to quote a lot of stuff out of the big book because I don't want newcomers to feel like they've got to memorize this big book. I want them to get it from their head, that 18 inches down to the heart. It says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick or the woman. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And the next paragraph walks you through the steps. Abandon yourselves to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And I want to tell you, don't ever set and try to figure out your life and what blessings you might get down the road. God has got so many wonderful blessings he wants to put in your life if you just open yourself up to it. Thank you.